Good morning and welcome back to
the second in this series of seminars, which we've called Digestible Yolk. The purpose of this series of seminars is to go through all of Jung's major ideas. And last time we did volume 5, today we're looking at volume 14. I changed the schedule a little bit. Preparing this material, I realized it was silly to try to do the whole volume 14 in one day. So this is just going to be part 1. Part 2 will be in the fall. And that material is in the back of your study guide, which means the very last workshop that I've thought would be spring of next year is going to be fall of the following year. So that's about the only real change. But I figured this material needed 2 weeks. I want to try to show you the evolution of Jung's ideas over the course of his life, how he developed what we call the self in Jungian psychology. And to that end, we started with volume 5, which was not a major work of his, but it's the work that he wrote while still close to Freud, because it shows how he started his ideas. And then what we'll do today is pick up and try to see the continuity between that, his first ideas, his later ideas, and then how his later ideas evolved. The study guide, which you all have got, I hope, and if you could chip in a buck for that, that'll save the Friends of Jung from photocopy costs. I just typed up probably the four most telling passages from that book, just to kind of remind you where we started, and then to be able to show you how he develops where he started. So I'm just going to read through the first couple of paragraphs and then mention where he has changed his ideas. If you remember the volume 5, written in 1913, was a study of a woman who was headed toward a psychosis. And she was taking a trip to Switzerland where she was going to study at the University of Geneva. And while on the boat, she had some fantasies which she recorded. Jung interpreted those fantasies. And the first incident was her being kind of romantically or erotically captivated by a sailor singing on the deck of this Italian ship. And Jung is going through this material to show how he would compare his ideas with Freud at the time as he's beginning to separate. And the Freudians would, of course, jump on something like that and say that what she's doing is projecting her father onto this sailor, which makes her excited to see him, but she never really followed through on it. And Jung said, no, I don't look at things that way. It is not that she's projecting the father onto this sailor. And by looking at material that we talked about last time, he tried to demonstrate his case. What she's really projecting onto the sailor is her inner capacity to be a hero in her own life. So what she's projecting onto the sailor is her inner hero. Then he spent quite a bit of time looking at what the hero does in myth. And what the hero does in myth, in the early pre-Christian myth from Egypt through Mesopotamia up to Greece, what the hero does is he descends. He fights some sort of battle, and sometimes he's killed, sometimes he's not killed, but usually he goes through some sort of journey of darkness, and then he emerges triumphant. And Jung's worked with that to say what the hero represents is her own capacity to descend into her own personality and discover who she is. So instead of this being a pathological projection, that it's her unresolved Electra issues with her father, it was really a projection of her capacity for self-knowledge, symbolized by the hero seen in this guy. So let me just now read you a couple of the passages, and they should say what I just said. Under the symbol of moth and sun, one of her fantasies was of a moth circling around the sun, which would be the desire for more consciousness, the sun being the light. We have dug deep into the historical layers of the psyche, and in the course of our excavations, we have uncovered the sun hero who revolves around the earth. That's what I just said. And who rises again in rejuvenated splendor to give light to new generations. For him, the dreamer longs with her very soul. For him, the soul moth burns her wings. So the moth would be a representative of the visionary or the patient, future patient, of actually not Jung's, but another fellow. Longing for light, which would be longing for the hero's discovery of a new illumination by descent and rebirth. Does that all sound familiar if you were here? The image that the myths often use is that when the hero descends into something which has mother associations to it, a tree, a whale, an ocean. And what Jung did then in Volume 5 was show how all those whale, tree, etc., ocean, have maternal associations in myth. So what the hero descends into is some maternal image. But again, in contrast to Freud, he would say, look, you see, there's incest again. Jung is saying, no, that is a purposive movement into a feminine state, into a receptive state, to be able to receive this new insight that the hero is seeking. So Jung then writes in paragraph 459, at this stage the mother symbol no longer connects back to the beginnings, but toward the unconscious as the creative matrix of the future. Big three words. Creative, four words actually, five words. I'm okay up to 10. Creative matrix of the future. Entry into the mother then means establishing a relationship between the ego and the unconscious. So the descent would be turning back to the inner world, the world of dreams, to try to understand their meaning. That is how Jung understood the presence of this hero image in the woman's fantasy. Now we're going to be looking at that phrase, creative matrix of the future. So the hero would be her own capacity to begin to turn back to herself. And then the idea Jung is presenting is when she does that, the inner life comes alive and dreams surface to guide her. So that the hero fantasy, not a father image, but a hero image, because he descends, would represent her ability to go into herself, find dreams in herself that would tell her what she needs to know to move forward in life. So Jung puts it this way, the unconscious takes over the forward striving function. In Jung's mind, what the unconscious has the capacity to do, if you turn to it, is produce images which guide you to where you need to go. Where Freud would see all those images as caused, Jung talks about them sometimes as caused, but more often as purposed, as having the ability to give you the information you need to move forward in life. That's the big difference between Freud and Jung. So the unconscious takes over the forward striving function. So the hero's descent would be her turning back to the dreams, which allows the unconscious to guide her through her dreams. Yeah.
Just for curiosity's sake, did Jung think that you have to deal with any of the other stuff, like in his last book, he said it could be this way, but it doesn't necessarily. It doesn't necessarily follow the concept of, do you have to work through some of that stuff to be able to get to...
Yes, hold on, because that's how he changed his ideas. At this point, let me just finish this passage, and we'll look at this passage, and then we're going to see how he changed his mind. The unconscious takes over the forward striving function, the process of transformation in time, and breaks the deadlock. The contents then pouring into consciousness are archetypal representations of what the conscious mind should have experienced if deadlock was to be avoided. So, in 1913, he is saying, all you have to do is turn back to your dreams and they begin to guide you. Well, that was before he had his own descent. Remember, he's writing this still feeling pretty much in charge of things, but this occasioned a break with Freud and would send him into a tizzy, and he spent 15 years looking at his own dreams. So he's writing this before that happened. The big change, and what the rest of this material will be about from now until the end, is how he changed his mind about that statement. That the unconscious will take over the forward striving function. That is correct. But what he failed to mention, and which he spent the rest of his life working on after his head got up out of the water, is a big if. The unconscious will take over the forward striving function if the conscious personality sets the conditions for this happening. So in this passage, you kind of get the idea. You turn back to your dreams and they start guiding you. And you realize it's not quite so simple. What you do is you turn back to the unconscious and you find one holy mess. And if you know how to work with that mess, then the dreams begin to guide you.
So what are you saying exactly? You have to be talking to the system of how to work with the unconscious?
What he will work out between now, starting this seminar till the end, is what must the ego do to make the unconscious cooperate, and how does that unconscious look when it does begin to cooperate? So he takes that very simple sentence and he expands it into a more complicated set of observations. What do we have to do? And then how does it look when the unconscious takes over the forward driving function? The idea which holds from here to the end is that the unconscious is creative. The unconscious is the creative matrix of the future. That holds. And the unconscious does take over the forward striving function. That holds. But it's not a free lunch.
Ego has to take responsibility.
Let's just say for the moment, for the chaos. That when the dreams appear initially, they don't appear in a way that looks like they have any guiding capacity. They look like a mess. And today is going to be one way of understanding that mess and one way of understanding what we have to do so that that mess turns into guidance.
So the ego helps
turn
that mess
into guidance. Right. Without the ego, and without the ego maintaining the proper attitude, this forward striving function will not emerge. That's the difference between early Jung and late Jung, and it's the bridge between this very first book and his later ideas.
And is that ego taking the right attitude, is that ego taking responsibility?
Right, but taking responsibility in several typical ways. And that's what we'll be doing today, is looking at what does it mean for the ego to take responsibility, and take responsibility for what and in what way. Because you could say that each of the major works that we'll be looking at examines another dimension of that taking responsibility. But I'm just trying to lay the groundwork now to give you a sense of how all these workshops hang together and why I put them in the order I have. I'll say a lot more about this before we get rolling. But the big key there is this basic idea that remains, that the unconscious creates the personality. That's the fourth quote. The dynamics of the unconscious creation of personality. Where I think most psychologists say that you create yourself. For Jung, you create the conditions for the unconscious to guide how you create yourself. So we're always looking to link up our conscious personality with this unconscious process, which does in fact know how your life is to evolve, if you can get it cooperating with you. That's the big if. And that's what I just typed up there in that last paragraph after the last in the paragraph after that last quote. Why is that so important? Because Jung feels there is such a thing as a genuine you. And the irony is, we don't have the knowledge of what that is. So the danger of our lifestyle is that we make decisions about what we believe, what we do, what we value, but they may not be in accord with that inborn, and that's the key word for Jung, with the inborn individuality that knows who you are. And that's what the dreams convey. Who you most essentially are, and how you can find the relationship, the job, the attitudes, the residences that allow that genuine capacity to evolve. The way he puts it is, consciousness is in danger of being led astray by its own light, by its own understanding, and becoming a rootless will-o'-the-wisp. That we don't attend to our real potentiality and our real identity, which Jung feels is given in each individual. So that takes us up to 1928. 1928 was when Jung got his feet back on the ground after his split with Freud. And by the time he had reemerged in 1928, he was 53, he pretty much understood the basics of what I just told you. So the transition from the unconscious will guide you to, it is much more complicated than that. We've got to look at the nature of the processes of the unconscious, understand how the ego relates to the unconscious so that this guidance can occur. That answering that question, how does that work, became Jung's life work. So from 1928 until 1944, he examined his own dreams. He examined dreams of his clients. He studied world myth to document what we'll be talking about shortly, all of the different paradigms that are necessary for understanding how the ego must relate to the unconscious to make it creative, and then how that creative unconscious works. I call that period of his life, from 1928 to 1944, his nuts and bolts period. He just researched dream after dream after dream to substantiate how does the ego relate to the unconscious to make it creative, and then what does it look like when the creative unconscious guides an individual through their life. In 1944, he was 69 and he had a heart attack. He almost died, and really I think would have been happy to pass on, but he heard voices in visions calling him back, so he sort of begrudgingly returned. And he said, I think, in effect, well, I could be dead. So I have a new lease on life, and I'm going to say it just like I feel it. The work he wrote from 1928 to 1944 is written with the reader in mind. But from 1944 until his death in 1961, so from the age of 69 until the age of 86, he said, to heck with the audience. I'm going to write my next books not from the point of view of the needs of the reader, but from the point of view of the needs of the material. That's why his last works are so difficult. He is not throwing the reader a sop whatsoever. He is simply taking all those images he has seen over the last 30 or 40 years and organizing them and presenting them to be true to their intent and saying to the reader, now you worry about understanding it. So the purpose of this workshop is to begin to introduce you, how do you approach these works, which are so very difficult. And they're difficult not because he doesn't know what he's talking about, but he doesn't really care whether we get it or not. He cares that it is written down for the sake of the images. These are the works we will be investigating for the rest of this workshop. The main work that we'll start with today is Jung's main work. He spent 10 years on this book, Mysterium Cunicionis, where most of his other books took him a couple of months. He considered it his magnum opus, his large work. It is almost impossible. Fortunately, we have on our own soil, actually, and he came from Indiana, a commentator who has made all of these works accessible, and that's Edward Ettinger. So if you look on the back of the study guide, for each of the works that we'll be talking about today, Mysterium, and the other works to follow, there's a study guide. This is Ettinger's Mysterium Lectures. And I've got to tell you, I do this full time. I've done this for 30 years. Without this, I couldn't understand this. This is enormously difficult. This makes it accessible. So he's done an amazing thing, amazing, given us an amazing service, providing a way in. What I hope to do, really, is just to prepare you to get ready to read this. I wouldn't recommend starting with any of these books directly. If you want to start tackling these books, start with the study guides. Read the study guides first. And what I hope to do in these next weeks is give you an overview of what are the main ideas Jung has talked about in each of the books, so that you, when you're reading one book, you don't get lost in the tree and miss the forest. So I'm going to try to give you an overview of each of the major ideas to prepare you for reading the study guide, so when you read the study guide, you can both get Jung's ideas and put them into perspective in the context of his whole opus. It's so easy to get frustrated in reading this material because he goes so deeply into the images that you just get lost and you forget that it is really part of a larger pattern. So I hope to give you a sense of the larger pattern so when you pick these things up, they will make sense. After having read this, then you can go and try and read the original works. But without Ettinger, I think we'd be lost. And I think now that Ettinger has published these books, really thanks to Inner City Books, there's no excuse for not understanding Jung anymore because he really does make it accessible. And he blows my mind what he got out of these texts. I don't know quite how he did it, but he did.
Aaron.
Yes.
Are you familiar with this one?
Yes, we'll look at that.
Okay, so
that's
it's just different from the one you did.
Well, that's a commentary. Yep, it's a commentary on Psychology of the Transference. So we'll talk about that
okay.
The very last class. See, you see the back of the guide, I've got all the workshops listed with the primary and secondary works. That was listed for, I think, Psychology of the Transference.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. As I said, Mysterium is his hardest work. I've gone through it with a group here a couple of years ago. We spent 100 hours on it. So I figured 5 hours ain't going to do it. So let's break it up into two. That's why I decided to do part one today. We'll do part two in the fall. This occupied Jung's last phase of Jung's life. And the other works we'll be looking at, Ion, Answer to Job, Synchronicity Essay, Psychology of the Transference, are all offshoots from this book. They are all written with the ideas Jung had around this book, but he didn't want to make it too big of a book. So the other books we'll be talking about are sort of offshoots of this book, and he took the ideas that he didn't want to burden us with in these books and and put them in those other works. That's why I've started with this book first, even though it's the hardest. I debated which way to proceed, to go with the easiest, or how to present this to you. I thought, why not just dive right in? And so it is difficult, but if we grasp this, then we will be able to see how the other works follow from this fundamental work. I do want to just confess, this is a work in progress, so if there are rough edges, you know, bear with me. But it's the first time I've presented it this way. I've discussed all of these books with groups anywhere from 50 to 100 hours per book, but I've never tried to condense them down. And we'll just see how it goes.
Nice.
Yeah.
I just looked at the introductory part in volume, and it's just that von Franz published a book at
yes.
the same time, and they were together. But in the English version, von Franz's work is to separate it out.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to look at it?
We'll look at that here.
Oh, we'll look. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot to mention that. I think if you look at the last week, the last class, last seminar, we're going to talk about that. I don't know what happened, but in the German edition, Marie-Louise von Franz, Jung's closest student, really, wrote a book called Aurora Consurgens. And it, in the German edition, it is published with this. Mysterium Phenomenalis in the German edition is published as two volumes. It was volume one and volume two. And her Aurora Consurgens is volume three. I don't know what happened in English, but it was excluded from the English. Inner City Books has published it. And we have gone through it. How long do we spend? Another 100 hours probably on the damn thing. It's a very rich book. But we'll look at that at the very end. It's very, very
good. That sounds fascinating. I missed that event.
Yeah, it's very, very. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Beautiful, beautiful. There is no study guide for that, but maybe someday I'll write one. Who knows? A little bit about Mysterium. The book is a study of images. Remember our very opening minutes last time, we talked about two types of thinking, directed thinking and symbolic thinking. This book is written from the symbolic point of view. So it's symbolic thinking, it is not linear thinking. That is another reason why it's frustrating. We are all used to thinking linearly, but the dreams operate thematically, not linearly. They do have a logic, but it's a symbolic logic. So what we're going to do, what I will try to do, is just give you, first of all, an overview of the book, and then we'll look at representative sections to give you a sense of how Jung's mind works. But it will be frustrating because each sentence in this book is going to be presenting us with something we don't understand. That's another reason why it's so difficult. Jung just said, you worry about it, you go to the Myth Dictionary, but what Edinger has done, what I will try to do, is give you the background for understanding these texts. But what we have to do is work on it image by image, looking at how the symbolic mind is presenting this material to try and translate it into our mode of understanding. I don't want to scare you away with the difficulty, but I would like to emphasize that I think that the book's difficulty is its strength. And it will reward you for the energy you put into it. To that end, let me tell you a story. Now, I'm a working class kid, so I'm going to tell you a story about money, but I mean money as a metaphor. I'm not trying to be elitist here with a money story. But I want to describe it to make a point as a metaphor for this book. When I was in Switzerland, I received a grant from the Rotary Club and allowed me to study there for a year, which really saved my life. And they assigned you a counselor to sort of look after you from the local Rotary Club. And I was assigned a restaurateur who owned about 50 or 100 restaurants. Very likable guy. His firm I saw recently just bought up the Radisson. So enormously successful businessman. And yet he had a hands-on approach to his restaurants, and he would buy all the wine that the restaurant served. So he would take his crew, he'd go to France once a year, and they would go wine tasting. Now, they're not a bunch of alcoholics. You know, when you taste wine to buy it, you don't drink it. You drink it and you spit it out. It's completely kosher. So he would take his crew to France, and they would spend a week just driving around these different chateaus, tasting wine and buying the year's supply of wine. So he told me that this story, which has always stuck with me, and I think it's very applicable to reading late Jung. He said that they were at a particular chateau. They were tasting some wine. I don't remember the exact price, but let's say one bottle was $5 a bottle. And the other bottle was $50 a bottle, something like that, a large difference in price. And they tasted them, and they were almost the same. And he said, well, I'll take, 500 cases of this one and 500 cases of that one. And one of his assistants said to him, now, why would you do that? Why would you buy that expensive wine when this $5 bottle is almost the same? He said, hold that question. So he said that evening, after a day's of wine tasting, they all went out to eat. And they had a lovely meal. They shared a bottle of wine together, probably a couple bottles of wine together. And At the end of the meal, the French have a cheese course, which is where the real conversation takes place. They serve cheese. They may sit for an hour to 3 hours talking, eating cheese and drinking wine. So during the cheese course, he ordered the $50 bottle and the $5 bottle. And he said to the woman, now, here's a glass, and he poured her a glass of each. Taste each of these. Taste the $5 bottle and taste the $50 bottle. And tell me what you think. What's the difference? She took the glass, sip of the five, sip of the 50, and she said, well, they're almost the same, except there's something about this $50 glass that you don't tire of. He says, that's what you pay for. That's the attitude you have to have toward this book. You have to put in a lot of energy. But after working on this for 30 years, I have not tired of it. There's a richness and an originality to it which will reward you for your effort. Well, as you've seen, I've got given us a lot of material in the study guide. I don't know how much of it we'll get through. We'll go as far as we can. To make things easy, sometimes I have given you Edinger's summary of the passages. And from time to time, just to give you a flavor of the book, I have given you Jung's passage, and we'll just read through it and try to understand it. I'm trying to strike a balance between getting things done and then giving you a sense of what this rich wine that Jung has given us is about. Okay, as we go to page one, we'll start off with the very first sentence of the book. Now, oh, let me back up a second. This might help you. There are two basic metaphors used in this book. Jung has gone to alchemy. Alchemy was, we talked about the introduction we did, I think, two seminars ago. Alchemy was an enterprise carried on, I'm making it very simple, by medieval pre-chemists who chemically worked with materials and thought in their mind's eye they were transforming them into gold or diamond or some elixir that would promote world wealth or world peace. Jung went to their writings, which are all done in an imaginative language. They didn't say, take 2 grams of sulfur or 2 grams of salt. They would say, take 2 grams of the sun. Sun was sulfur. 2 grams of the moon. Moon was salt. And express in a symbolic language what they thought was going on in the material. Jung then interpreted this as a projection of an inner transformation process which they were seeing on the material. That's all, hopefully, what we covered in the very first series of this that I did. So the Jung then went to the alchemical understanding of the transformation of material and interpreted that as a metaphor for the psychological transformation of our inner personality. Why alchemy? Well, it lends itself very easily to the transformation process that we're talking about, and also because it was the last time that the non-linear mind was operating prior to the Enlightenment. With the Enlightenment, all that got called superstition, and Jung didn't say to go to Greek myth because alchemy absorbed Greek myth. He didn't go to Egyptian myth because alchemy absorbed Egyptian myth. These guys were thinking symbolically with all the traditions of the past, and their work is just peppered with every image from world mythology, well, at least Western mythology, and even Arabic mythology as well. So Jung went to this period when the symbolic mind was still alive, and it is very apt for understanding the transformation process because it shows the major paradigms of this relationship between the ego and the unconscious that Jung had experientially found in his work with himself and his work with clients. The two major paradigms are opposites and their synthesis and extraction. I've listed there at the bottom of page one. So the rest of the day today, we're going to be looking at these two basic paradigms. In other words, the alchemists thought when they cooked their material, there were conflicting entities. Now, their mind is still thinking there are things living in that material. So they describe these as people in there. There are entities in that material that are in chaos, and as the alchemists worked on them, they separate, and as the alchemists worked on them further, they united, and often it's a sexual image of union, and out of that came a pregnancy, and a child was born. And when that child was born, the material in their mind would turn to lead or gold. The lead or the worthless material, the conflicting elements, would turn into gold or diamond. So Jung then takes that as the first paradigm for this relationship between the ego and the unconscious, that when you look at that chaos that I referred to earlier, it is actually opposites in conflict. And what the ego has to do is begin to recognize what those opposites are, and we'll see that through the rest of the day, and bring them into unity. That's the work of today. The other main metaphor is one of extraction, that they thought that this redeemed condition that they were trying to produce from the material, the gold or the diamonds or the elixir, was somehow hidden in that material, and if they cooked it the right way, they could extract it. And Jung is going to take that as the second main metaphor we'll be looking at today for this relationship between the ego and the unconscious. When you face this chaos, what we try to do is extract the meaning of it. So two major paradigms, may not make sense now, hopefully it will by the end of the day. Two main paradigms, the opposites and their synthesis, and secondly, the extraction of the redeemed state from the initial state. Our big challenge today will be time. So as I said last time, I do want to entertain questions, that's fine, but try to keep them like to clarify your understanding. We really don't have time to get off on your opinions about things. I mean, when I do these smaller groups where we spend hours on these books, I do encourage that, but I feel my goal today is to give you information. And so if your questions are limited to, I don't understand this, that's fine, but let's try to stay away from opinions and things like that, just for the sake of time. So here's the first paragraph, the first sentence in Mr. M. The factors which come together in the conjunctio are conceived as opposites, either confronting one another in enmity or attracting one another in love. So this emotional confusion that we find when we turn back to ourself is made up of opposites in conflict. In other words, when you are in an outer situation in life, which has become a problem, a marriage problem, a work problem, depression, despair, you name it. In Jung's mind, there is behind that state an emotional condition of chaos, which analytic work then begins to explore. And when we explore those emotions, when the hero turns back to the unconscious, what he will find is opposites in conflict. And those opposites can be of a dual nature. They can either be opposites attracting each other, you know, like I can't stop thinking about my neighbor's wife, or opposites in opposition to each other, I'd like to kill my neighbor. This is the ground state that we are trying to get back to. Whatever outer problem is presented, we try to take it back to the inner chaos and then attend to that chaos until we see what are the opposites in conflict. And then begin to take responsibility for those opposites own them as parts of ourselves, as opposed to blaming other people for the problems in our life. Is that okay? Basic idea. Now, what Jung does is start off with that very basic idea, and then he goes off on page after page of giving examples of those opposites. How might they symbolize themselves in dreams? Well, as two animals in conflict. So dreams of two people fighting, animals fighting, would be indicative of this phase of the process. Now, the next page two, I have taken a picture that Jung refers to, and I've given you his quote on it. So let's go through this. Now, this will be tough, but we'll go through it sentence by sentence. He has started with his idea of the opposites, and now he is giving example after example in alchemical texts for this conflict in order to understand what is the nature of that conflict, and then to interpret that metaphorically, how do we come into harmony with it. What do we do from there, in other words? So now I'm quoting from paragraph 5 and paragraph 6, and I will go slowly. This is a picture from an alchemical text. I don't know, is the sun on it too bright to see? I can't. You can see it okay? Okay. These are goddesses. The goddesses represent the four seasons of the sun and the circle of the zodiac. Aries, Cancer, Libra, Capricorn. And at the same time, the 4 degrees of heating, now here comes the new thing, as well as the four elements combined around the circular table. The synthesis of the elements is effected by means of the circular movement in time. Now, the alchemists would use Latin, circulatio, or rota, or rotation, of the sun through the houses of the zodiac. Now what this is literally is an alchemical recipe. It doesn't make sense to us because they wrote very intentionally cryptically. One alchemist is saying that the transformation of lead or worthless chaos into gold is this process whereby four elements in the material gather around a table and are brought into a unity by virtue of the sun traversing the heavens. The trick here is always asking yourself, what level are we talking on? The literal level of this picture, which is a picture from a medieval manuscript with description. And we will look at the examples of such descriptions, is that in the material are four different elements symbolized here by the four sun goddesses. And they're in conflict. But what the alchemist does is heat the material in the right way to bring these four goddesses to a table. And then as the sun goes through the courses of the heavens, these four people are brought into a unity. And when that unity is produced, gold is produced. Jung's interpretation is this is what happens when you turn back to yourself. You look at all the different parts of yourself that are not in harmony, where you are in conflict with yourself. You face them, you bring them into awareness, into a single awareness, that would mean That would be the sitting at the table. And if you maintain awareness of them, they will harmonize into the unity symbolized by the table. And that end point is this guidance of the unconscious that we talked about earlier. So the unity of the personality would be the knowledge of who you are in essence, which can lead you forward into a genuine life. But it has to be constructed out of the conflicting elements. Now, here is the puzzle. The book is called Mysterium Conjunctionis, Mysterious Union. How does that happen? That when you take responsibility for the four here, four ingredients, or the conflicting ingredients of your own psyche, synthesis happens. We don't know why. We only know it happens and that it's a mystery. You don't produce it. You produce the precondition. The precondition is getting all your pieces around the table. In other words, admitting all your tendencies. I brought along some dreams to illustrate this shortly. But we're just meeting the paradigm for the first time. It can be 2, 4, 8, usually multiples of 2 or 4.
So you're saying unity happens to you, you don't, the ego doesn't.
The ego cannot make it occur. The ego can make it not occur by not facing the conflicts. But when facing the conflict, our responsibility is to admit what's there, to see its contradictory nature, and I may say to stop blaming other people for the chaos in the outer world that these inner conflicts cause, and simply live with it. Right. For as far as he's concerned, that's projected onto Christ. We'll talk about that, I think, the next to the last seminar.
So
Jung uses the Chinese word wu wei, actively non-doing. You have to be active in the sense of acknowledging and generally suffering the humility to admit you have these tendencies and that they are not, you are not of one mind, that you do contradictory things and you are hypocritical and you say one thing but may do another, or you may say two things in conflict. And that's your job. Just that. And then to live with that knowledge while continuing to watch the dreams until they shift and begin producing a new image, which would here be represented by the table, and that would be the true self that has the knowledge to guide. And it is fundamentally a mystery. That's why the book is called Mysterious Union.
So, not known astrology, if those animals that they were...
Yes, they're each of the Aries, Cancer, Libra, Capricorn. And of course, that is, again, a metaphor for our Libra tendencies, our Aries tendencies, our Cancer tendencies, our Capricorn tendencies.
Are they in opposition?
They're described in the text. This is just a picture, but yeah. The text describes them as in opposition, yes.
So the conflicting elements are the words on the table?
On the table, right.
And then, okay,
Garrett, those are all cardinal signs in astrology, which means they're initiators. So that's the one thing the four have in common, because they're different elements. One's fire, one's water, one's earth, and one's
Air.
Air.
See, that's a very helpful comment, because when you face these things, they are demoralizing. I mean, I'm sure you can all think, just in this past week, of people who put you in a double bind. See, that's the opposites. I was talking to somebody about a future talk, not here, and the individual said, well, here's my suggested date. If that doesn't work, let me know. So I said, it actually doesn't work, and they got mad. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Watch your own contradictions. Watch the contradictions of other people. Those are the opposites. Yeah.
Well, there's four of them. So there's not just one set of opposites. They're actually in a square with one another. So is he saying that the inner conflicts are not just polarity? That they're
sometimes they can be bigger than polarity.
Yeah. So it's like you're caught. Well, it would be almost like the cross. Because if there's four of them and you're in the middle, no matter which direction you go, somebody's unhappy.
Yeah, exactly. If you've got two, you're lucky.
Yeah.
Okay. Often it's. But I want to follow up on Sandy's comment just for a second. When you meet these fragments of your personality, it is a moral defeat. It feels like a moral defeat. But they are initiators for the construction of a larger selfhood. So, from the glass half empty stage, you feel defeated, but in retrospect, you realize they are, what was the word you used? Did you say initiate? Or they are initiating you to find the bigger piece that contains them all, and so in that sense, they're purposive. Yeah, sorry.
A question on the chart on the zodiac, and I say since the cardinal signs are out there, they're the cross country. They're one of three crosses. Yeah, but they do form opposites.
Yeah, so they form a cross.
Okay, that's the basic idea. The book comes back to this basic idea again and again and again, presenting all sorts of variations on who is it that's in conflict, what are typical images used in the dreams to symbolize those conflicts, and what are typical images used to symbolize the resolution of that conflict. Now that is what Jung studied in these alchemical texts, all the variety of ways this was symbolized and all the variety of ways that it was resolved, and that's what we're going to be doing. So I think once you get the basic idea down, you don't get as lost in the details. Because you'll be reading along pretty soon, he's going to be in Egypt, and then he'll be in Persia, and then he'll be in the South Seas talking about some image. You think, what in the world is it talking about? Well, what it is, it's varieties on this basic theme. So if you can always keep the basic theme in mind, I think you can stay on track.
So they are all feminine because of what you're saying.
Well, but the sun, you see.
Oh, but except the sun.
The sun is depicted as a woman with a male head. See, it is itself a mixture of opposites. They're called the sun goddesses.
But those figures there, are they feminine?
They're supposed to be.
Yeah.
But with the sun head, which is masculine.
Oh, I see. They all have this. Missed that little point.
She wants some sleep.
Let's see if we can get one more paragraph done and we'll take a break. The next is right out of Jung's writing, and I'll go through it with you sentence by sentence. Please don't have a heart attack. It will make sense, but at first reading it won't. So this is quoting from paragraph 5 and 6 of Mysterium. I'll go slowly. Austenes, by the way, is the name of the alchemist. Hymarmony is the word meaning the compulsion of the stars. Hymarmony means you are controlled by external forces, represented by astrological constellations, but with a negative idea that you can't free yourself from the curse of the stars. So you could roughly say fate, or you could say fated influences in the ancient mind from the constellation of the stars. So he's caught. It's a text of a man who feels he is caught by fate. And these fateful powers that have caught him are emanating from the stars. Austenes said, this is an alchemical text Jung is simply quoting to us from a medieval manuscript that he had collected. Austenes said, "Save me, O my God, for I stand between two exalted brilliances known for their wickedness, and between two dim lights. Each of them has reached me, and I know not how to save myself from them." So he feels controlled by polarities that are descending from the heaven and are manipulating his life. He doesn't feel free. So he simply projected the opposites onto the heavens. "And it was said to me, go up to Agathodaimon the Great." Agathodaimon means the good serpent, the good demon. "And ask aid of him, and know that there is in thee somewhat of his nature which will never be corrupted." So the opposites would be the powers that he's caught in. And now the beginning of the solution of his problem is this ascent to the good demon. And this, remember, is a recipe. This is an alchemical recipe. "And when I ascended into the air, he said to me, take the child of the bird, which is mixed with redness, and spread for the gold its bed, which comes forth from the glass, and place it in its vessel, whence it has no power to come out except when thou desirest, and leave it until its moistness has departed." Now Jung's going to explain what that means. The quaternio, the four, in this case, evidently consists of two malefici, I guess that's pronounced, meaning two bad influences, Mars and Saturn. Mars is the ruler of Aries and Saturn of Capricorn. The two dim lights would then be feminine ones, the Moon, the ruler of Cancer, and Venus, ruler of Libra. The opposites between which Austenes stands are thus masculine and feminine on the one hand, and good and evil on the other. So that's, they are, we have been introduced to the opposites.
There are a lot of studies going on right now in medieval and Hellenistic astrology, so they're translating a lot of the Old Testament, and they work with, they actually, I was at a week-long workshop last year, so it's really in-depth, but at the time that these texts were put out, Mars was the ruler of Aries, but it was also the ruler of Scorpio, which is a fixed sign. So you're going from action to fixity. And Venus ruled Libra, but also ruled Taurus, which was also a fixed sign. And the Saturn ruled Capricorn. Well, Saturn was Capricorn, but also Aquarius, which is a fixed sign. The difference in them is the Moon, which is Cancer, and that's the cardinal sign. But the Sun is Leo, which is the fifth sign. So it's almost like there's this transformation going on between activity and fixity, the feminine and the masculine, which without knowing a lot of the translations of these other texts, are more difficult to deal with. Now that these are being translated, a lot of the Jungian work is going to make a lot more sense also, I think.
Well, the basic idea is that he's calling it conflict.
There's so much going on here that unless there's an understanding of
it. Now, that's not this. That is not this.
No, but I mean, it's the same basic.
Right.
Those are cardinal.
Right.
But there's more to it than just cardinality. There's the symbology and the fixity that goes along also.
For our purposes, I'm trying to simplify this.
Yeah, I didn't need it. I'm just
just think of conflict, conflicting forces. The way he speaks of the four luminaries, he does not know how to save himself from them, suggests that he is subject to Himarmony, the propulsion of the stars. That is, to a transconscious factor beyond the reach of human will. Namely, that he is possessed by powers that are beyond his willpower. Does that make sense? Okay. Apart from this compulsion, the injurious effect of the four planets is due to the fact that each of them exerts its specific influence on man and makes him a diversity of persons, whereas he should be one. So we're going from conflict to unity. That's the basic model. It is presumably Hermes who points out to Austenes that something incorruptible is in his nature, which he shares with the Agathodaimon, something divine, obviously the germ of unity. So that potential for wholeness is there. And then what the process of facing the opposite does is it activates it. Don't ask me why, but that's the way we're built. This germ is the goal. Now we get a bunch of different words for the end state. Not really important for our beginning purposes, but I'll read them anyway. This germ is described as the gold, orum philosophorum, the gold of philosophers. Now, the alchemists called themselves philosophers. So when you read philosopher, it means alchemist. And they distinguish between the alchemist's gold, which is a kind of a spiritual gold, versus the crude gold, which is wealth, monetary wealth. So the gold, the philosopher's gold, the bird of Hermes, or the son of the bird, who is the same as the Phileus philosophorum, the son of the philosophers, all different words for the end state, what is produced out of the alchemical process. He must be enclosed in the vas hermeticum, which means the alchemical vessel, and heated until the moistness that clings to him has departed. That is the humidum radical, the radical moisture, the prima materia. The prima materia is simply another word for the beginning state, which is the original chaos. That's why we're looking at this. These are all images of the chaos. And the sea, another image of the chaos. Some kind of coming to consciousness seems indicated. So that this whole process must be cooked, which psychologically means focused on in a state of emotional tension and lived with. That's the cooking.
In the unity that emerges, are the original elements still present?
They're present, but in a larger context. So that the larger context in meeting all the pieces diffuses the conflict between them. Again, I'll give you examples. I'm just trying to give you the basic paradigm. Eileen?
I'm not sure if I understand the radical moisture.
That would be the shadow. That you have to not only face your conflict, but you have to be able to admit to where you are less than honest in dealing with these things. Shadow makes sense, hopefully. Everybody knows. Okay. Yeah.
Could it also be moods, which are very wet? You know, you get real soppy if the unconscious grabs you with a mood.
Well, particularly if in that mood you start funking what you need to do.
Right. Or even, I think the conflict is heat is when you're conscious and you know you're in the mood, but you know you're in the mood and you can't get out of it. So rather than just giving in to the mood, that you somehow try to stay in awareness of it and struggle with it, which would be, I think, what this cookie is about.
Well, but also remember that there's a polarity involved.
Yeah.
So there's a polarity involved here. You finally admit you have these conflicting tendencies, and you don't know what to do about it. You see how you sabotage yourself, but you don't know anything beyond it. And you feel defeated. And in that emotional state, it gets hot. It is a emotionally activated time. So, you see, we're sort of embellishing this idea of looking at conflict, and we're learning that it's hot to do so. And that we have a certain part of the goal in ourselves. And what we're doing is trying to create the condition for that thing to get stronger and heal the conflict. But for Jung, you see, it's in there in the beginning. It's just not actively present in your life. We know that the synthesis of the four was one of the main occupations of alchemy. And was, though to a lesser degree, the synthesis of the several, for example, metals. All that is what we've already talked about, hopefully. Thus, in the same text, Hermes, now we're going to see a lot more Hermes in a minute. Hermes says to the sun, I caused to come out to thee the spirits of thy brethren, the planets of sun, and I make them for thee a crown, the like of which was never seen. So here's another image of the redeemed condition, the crown. Circular images are what we can expect as the conflicting elements come into a unity. And I will make thy kingdom vigorous, so that the production of the resolved condition brings back the vigor that was lost when the conflict demoralized us. This refers to the synthesis of the planets or the metals with the sun to form a crown, which will be within Hermes. Don't worry about that. We'll talk about Hermes shortly. The crown signifies the kingly totality. It stands for unity and is not subject to hymarmony. So the end condition gives one the strength not to be controlled and flipped back and forth between these opposing forces that were once felt to be so devastating.
But those forces are still there.
They're there, but they have lost their controlling power. And they are felt to be essential ingredients to some larger aspect of yourself. And as maybe aspects of yourself that you can visit, but not in a way that that control you compulsively and in a way that no longer seem conflicting.
And then part of that is probably because they are brought into consciousness.
The broader consciousness, but the big thing for Jung is always something else gets started.
Yeah.
And that's this self. So this rest of this course is on what Jung calls the self. We talked a little bit about it in the introduction. Another dimension of your personality emerges and gives you strength and confidence where before you had none. Yeah, Kate.
So the circular image, the table, or the crown, it sounds like that's kind of the process of bringing them together, but it's also the result.
Yes. Yes. You've moved us on to Mercurius. Let me just mention this, and we'll come back to it. Mercurius, Now, so what the alchemists have done is they've symbolized all parts of this process with different images of divinities from Greek or Persian or Egyptian mythology. This process now of going from a confused mass to a recognition of the various parts, to their synthesis in the new dimension of yourself, which emerges, symbolized by circles, diamonds, gold, images of divinity, images of sacred water, for example. That process is all mercurius in their mind. Now remember, we're dealing with the medieval mind, and it doesn't bother them that this is a contradiction. Bothers us, doesn't bother them. Mercurius is the Latin word for Hermes. Hermes is the Greek god, the Greek messenger. Mercurius, and I'll show you some pictures shortly. Mercurius is the beginning of the process. Mercurius is the four pieces spread out together. Mercurius is the conflict. And Mercurius is the end of the process. And Mercurius is the drive to go from the first state to the second state. He's everything. He is representative of the alchemical process. Beginning point, separation of opposites, unity, and the power that makes that happen. Let's have a stretch, and we'll look at some dreams to put some flesh on what I've talked about.